Welcome to RHRealityCheck.org's RealityCast, where we inject truth into the sex and reproductive health debate. Each week, we'll be bringing you news, opinion, and advice on sexual health issues, as well as interviews with some of the most prominent names in sexual health advocacy. Here's your host, Amanda Marcotte.
On this episode of RealityCast, it's a whole lot of discussion and dissection of the Stupak Pitts Amendment to the House Healthcare Reform Bill. I'll be looking at its impact and why it happened in two separate segments. Also, Megan Carpentier will be on to talk about the Oklahoma law requiring women who have had abortions to put their private information online. I'd like to highlight a video posted on RH Reality Check with an article by David Neipert.
2 years ago, Belmont Abbey College discovered that its health insurance policy for its staff covered abortion, contraception, and sterilization. While such coverage is in keeping with North Carolina law, the college administration told its employees that it was removing this coverage from the plan. Their reason? The college is owned by Benedictine monks, and the health coverage was in conflict with the teachings of the Catholic Church.
8 professors have filed suit with the EEOC, and the EEOC determined that it was indeed gender discrimination. Good for the professors of Belmont. Unless you're living under a rock, you've probably heard the terrible news.
On this vote, the yeas are 240, the nays are 194, with one voting present. The amendment's adopted. Without objection, the motion to reconsider is laid on the table. The unfinished business is the vote on the amendment printed in Part D of House Report 111-330, offered by the gentleman from Ohio, Mr. Boehner, on which the yeas and nays were ordered. The clerk will redesignate the amendment.
That's right. The pig-headed religious fanatic that's Bart Stupak, that's been on and on about how the health care bill needs to be rewritten so that women can't get coverage for abortion, got his way. He got an amendment attached to the House health care reform bill that makes it illegal for insurance companies to provide abortion coverage to any woman who has subsidized care, even if they pay for it with non-federal money. A lot of anti-choicers are trying to play this off as if it was the same old thing they've always done, which is bad enough, which is stopping federal funding for abortion. But that's a lie, as Diane Archer explained on Grit TV.
Came as a total shock. It's unconscionable. I mean, this amendment really does take restrictions on women's ability to get coverage to a whole new level. As we all know, it's always been the case, or for a long time it's been the case, that the federal government has not been willing to put federal dollars towards paying for abortion coverage, but to prevent individuals from buying insurance coverage with their own money that covers abortions is really unconscionable.
What absolutely needs to be understood is that in no way, shape, or form is this an attempt to actually reduce the number of abortions. How do I know that? Because abortion coverage wasn't the only thing that anti-choicers blocked. There were many attempts early on to mandate that health insurance companies cover contraception, but no version of the bill has that language left in it. Anti-choicers made a fuss about abortion and were able to quietly make sure that as many women possible are forced to have them. Because, and say it with me now, this is about punishing sex and has nothing to do with life. As Ezra Klein noted in the Washington Post, this is also and mainly a class issue. The anti-sex agenda doesn't really make sense until you look at it from this perspective. Many anti-sex folks are fine with sex for themselves, it's just those other people that they don't like having sex. And other generally means poor people. The women that will be most affected by this ban on abortion and the lack of contraception coverage are women who need subsidies to buy insurance because they can't afford this themselves. I guess the idea of poor people having sex just really makes some people mad, you know. Estimates suggest that 10 million women are at risk of forced childbirth for the sin of being working class and having sex. Which probably goes a long way to explaining why many ostensibly pro-choice Democrats voted for this amendment. Because part of it was that religious fanatics like Stupak were belligerent in their demands and said they would not vote for the health care bill if it was neutral on abortion. A lot of the media made it sound like the Democrats were facing a loss of 40 votes on this, but as James Clyburn explained on MSNBC, that's not so.
Remember, we keep using the number 40 and 41. It was not 40 votes that we were trying to get with this amendment. There was only about 10 or 11 votes. That's the fact. We were sitting right at 207, 208, We needed to get to 218, and we were there without this language. This language took us across the threshold of 218, but that was only about 10 people. So it was never 40 or 41 people, as was reported.
That said, those 10 votes were probably a make-it-or-break-it number for passing this bill. But it's hard to say, honestly. What we do know is this isn't over yet. The Senate has to reconcile this bill with their bill, and the pro-choice case is much stronger in the Senate. Representative Schultz went on MSNBC to explain.
I am confident that when it comes back from the conference committee, that that language won't be there, and I think we're going to all be working very hard, particularly the pro-choice members, to make sure that that's the case.
Certainly, one reason this whole thing blew up like this was that it seemed, until the last minute, like Nancy Pelosi would be able to keep a lid on this anti-woman nonsense. As Terry O'Neill explains, even those of us who are aware of the anti-choice sentiment in Congress didn't think it would be this bad.
It definitely caught me off guard. On Saturday morning, I started getting calls and emails and texts saying, you know, that there's a deal that's been cut, and it's a terrible, disastrous deal. The Stupak-Pitts Amendment, in fact, I believe, essentially overrules Roe v. Wade. That's the intention of the Catholic bishops who pushed it. That I believe, is the intention of Mr. Stupak and Mr. Pitts, who offered it. And it is an outrage. And we are doing everything to be sure that it does not get into the Senate bill, that it does not survive the reconciliation process.
Well, the veil has been lifted, and now we see how deep the anti-woman sentiment has gotten in Congress and in the mostly male political circles of the federal government. So hopefully we won't be caught by surprise again. In the next segment on the Stupak-Pitts Amendment, and after the interview, I'll look at some of the machinations behind the scenes that allowed this amendment to pass. I'd like to welcome Megan Carpentier to the program. Megan has worked for Wonkette and Jezebel and is currently employed by Air America. She was instrumental in breaking the story about Oklahoma's law mandating that women having abortions post all this private information online under the guise of some kind of sociological government survey. She's here today to talk about this law and the larger assault on women's privacy. Welcome to RealityCast, Megan.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, a temporary restraining order has been put on this law after the Center for Reproductive Rights sued Oklahoma. But if the center loses and the law goes into effect, what would it do exactly?
Well, what it would do would be establish an agency within the Department of Health that would be responsible for tracking what opponents of reproductive rights term demographic information about women who are seeking abortion. And so because Oklahoma already has a waiting period, when you go in for your first meeting before you can actually have an abortion, the doctor will have to take a 37-question survey plus fill out his or her own portion of the survey and submit that information to the health department. Among those 37 questions, there will be questions related to the county you live in, the county you're seeking an abortion in, your age, the number of pregnancies you've had, carried to term, the number of miscarriages you've had, on and on and on, in such a way that, particularly in smaller communities in Oklahoma, it will likely make women very identifiable through this database, which will be sortable for quote-unquote researchers that are trying to figure out what causes women to have abortions.
I think one of the questions I found most interesting was the one about whether or not a woman was a state employee. Why do you think they included that specific question?
Well, there were actually a couple of questions that were sort of in that vein. I assume two reasons. One is to see if you are a political appointee, particularly because most administrations in Oklahoma tend to be Republicans. And two, because under federal law, federal employees aren't allowed to use their federal employee health insurance to pay for what federal law terms abortions of choice. That is to say, your insurance can pay for an abortion if the doctor deems it medically necessary under very strict guidelines. In effect, what ends up happening is most abortions are not covered for federal and, in some cases, state employees' health insurance programs. And one of the other series of questions that's asked of doctors and patients is how the woman is paying for the abortion, whether it's through private health insurance, whether it's through Medicaid or Medicare. So they're obviously trying to get at who is paying for it in order to make it as difficult as possible for women to do anything other than pay for abortion services out of pocket.
So this is far from an isolated incident when it comes to anti-choicers making a grab for women's very personal information. And it's definitely more about shaming than anything else. Can you talk some about the Kansas incident involving Bill O'Reilly? I saw you talk about that on the Rachel Maddow show.
Sure. What happened there is the state of Kansas had an attorney general who was particularly keen to use the powers of his office to try to eliminate abortions in the state. If you talk to people in Kansas, they did things. They lost a huge case on education funding, for instance, during that time because the top lawyers in the office were spending all their time litigating abortion rights and cost the state millions and millions of dollars. It's actually one of the reasons why he lost re-election. In this particular case, what he did was he went after Planned Parenthood and said that Planned Parenthood wasn't reporting appropriately women or young women who had abortions who were underage, who thus their partners would have been subject to statutory rape or child rape laws under Kansas law. And what he wanted to do was review all the records of all the abortions that Planned Parenthood had performed in the state of Kansas to make sure that Planned Parenthood was complying with state law on when to notify law enforcement. They litigated it through the courts. Planned Parenthood lost. They had to turn over their records with some names redacted to the state attorney general's office, and within a couple of weeks, those records somehow found their way to Bill O'Reilly's program, which he used to do a whole segment on abortion in Kansas. And so women who were seeking a perfectly legal medical procedure in the state of Kansas had their medical records reviewed by Bill O'Reilly and Bill O'Reilly's extensive staff in order to allow him to do a story about them.
I covered this law earlier on the podcast, and my sense is that a lot of the desire to out and shame women who have had abortions is not just about punishment, but it's Bill O'Reilly. There's a prurient interest in there. You know, it's like that punishing women who have had sex is the way that the anti-sex crowd kind of titillates itself. How do you feel about that particular theory? Am I kind of off the rocker on that?
Well, no, I mean, I think that's a lot of where sort of anti-choice and right-wingers come down on sex issues. I think that Pam Spalding had a great thing on her blog this morning about the anti-gay marriage people in Maine talking about, you know, the lifestyles of gay people and how they were, you know, disgusting and blah, 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 deviant and all those sorts of things. And the amount that it seems to me that the conservative movement, whether it comes to LGBT rights issues or reproductive choice issues, the amount they focus on sex as an act just continually astonishes me. I mean, I will admit I think about sex a lot. I think a lot of people think about sex a lot, but I think about it like in terms of my life, and I don't really think a lot about what other people are doing because, frankly, it's a lot less interesting. I mean, I'm not saying I have some crazy sex life, but it's just mine's more interesting to me. Maybe that makes me a narcissist, but it just seems like these people that are so opposed to women's reproductive choice, that are opposed to rights and equality for LGBT Americans, are so obsessed with what other people are doing sexually that it kind of freaks me out, honestly. Like, I'm sort of like, I feel like every time I talk about abortion or sex or these people write me, they're like so concerned with what kind of sex that I'm having that it just doesn't really make any sense to me.
Recently, there was a situation, I'm sure you've been following this. There was a Planned Parenthood employee that switched to the anti-choice side. Yeah, Abby Johnson. And she was accused of smuggling patient files out to give to her anti-choice friends. And so now what we're seeing, I think, is like that's clearly targeting individual women in a very obvious way. Do you think we're going to be seeing more attempts to do this? I mean, the Oklahoma law seems like it's very focused on individuals.
I think that the anti-choice movement goes back and forth on this tactic. I think when they shame individual women, when they go after individual women, when they try to criminalize women getting abortions, they get a lot of pushback from people in the middle that think that there should be some room with restrictions for women to have access to abortion. And when they go after women and demonize women and show up at women's houses and are, you know, shown on camera screaming at sort of crying women, then you don't know the reasons that they're going for an abortion, just seeing them outside of a Planned Parenthood, that really loses them sympathy. And so in the last few years, they've been very, the leaders of a lot of the anti-choice groups have been very smart about going after doctors and criminalizing doctors' actions and putting the onus on doctors and, you know, talking about abortion mills and doctors getting rich off of doing abortions and these sorts of things. And that's a much more, sadly, effective technique for the anti-choice movement. I think the difficulty for these people is they're, at the same time that they're trying to make the public face of their movement much more accessible to mainstream America, they're fomenting this level of, like, hatred among their supporters that really isn't sustainable, because once you sort of get all these people ginned up and screaming and outside abortion clinics, and you get the Scott Roeders of the world that start shooting at doctors, and you get these people that go outside and protest in women's houses and turn over private medical records to folks for the sole purpose of harassing women, those are the sorts of things that start to turn mainstream America against them. And I think the difficulty is you can't, on the one hand, be this, like, sort of super family-friendly, you know, these doctors are making money off of women's pain, kind of, like, as disingenuous as that is, kind of movement, and turn out people to protest at abortion clinics based on, like, doctors making money. You can only turn those people out through hatred and through the kinds of actions that you're seeing in Texas, in Oklahoma, these individual shaming actions against women that really go against mainstream. And so I think they're swinging much more in that direction because they're being pulled by the grassroots people that they've been ginning up for so many years to just hate abortion, women who choose to have it, women who seek it, doctors who perform it, the secretary who, like, buzzes you into the office, the contractors that are fixing the roof. You know, when you're just ginning up hatred against individual people for what is essentially a political and more so a religious question, you're not going to be able to keep that family-friendly, disingenuously concerned veneer on your movement.
So one last question. Since you've been following this Oklahoma situation closely, how do you feel the Center for Reproductive Rights is going to fare? What are their arguments against this law, and how are they able to, what are their chances of overturning it?
Well, Oklahoma is one of several states where they don't like the bundling of bills, and, like, they very often do in Congress, where you saw, say, the Matthew Shepard Act attached to the defense authorization bill. So hate crimes legislation passed because it was attached to an armed services bill. A lot of states won't allow constitutionally their legislatures to do that. They want legislators to pass bills on their own merits. What the Center for Reproductive Rights did in the last horrible set of abortion laws that the state passed is they argued successfully in court that because the bills did several different disparate things on abortion rights, that the bill itself was unconstitutional, and the courts agreed. And that's the sort of very limited tactic that they're taking this time, is because the bill does several things, including criminalizing certain kinds of abortions and changing language on abortions and instituting this program and authorizing money. They're saying the bill does several different things and thus violates Oklahoma's constitution. On that level, they've been successful before. They will probably continue to be successful. What they're trying to do is avoid the courts in Oklahoma and or outside of Oklahoma making this into a larger issue because they don't know which way the higher courts will rule. And that's been where the abortion rights movement, the choice movement, has been for a very long time, trying to keep few cases from going to the Supreme Court, being, I think, rightfully concerned that the Supreme Court will uphold them, as they saw with the partial birth abortion ban, where the Supreme Court ruled that was perfectly legal.
My guest today has been Megan Carpentier, and you can read her writing at the Air America blog. Thanks for coming on to RealityCast, Megan.
Thanks so much for having me.
Now that the Stupak Pitts Amendment has passed, it's time to ask some serious questions about how this happened. The most obvious answer is that Capitol Hill is still dominated by a bunch of middle-aged men that will never be pregnant themselves, and so think that anyone who does worry about it is being silly. But the answer is really more complicated than that. Let's start with the man who pushed forward this unconscionable legislation, Bart Stupak. Stupak is a Democrat from Michigan, and in interviews, he comes across as a tone-deaf sexist who particularly resents that he has to live under Nancy Pelosi's leadership. It turns out that Stupak is a member of the notorious C Street family, an elitist fundamentalist Christian cult that many congressmen belong to. We've had Jeff Charlotte on this podcast before to talk about the family, and he went on Rachel Maddow to explain further.
Are there signs that the family had anything to do with the Stupak Pitts Amendment? I mean, this is quite a legislative coup that they've pulled off.
Well, you have to consider that Congressman Pitts is what the family calls a core member. This is a little bit like being the board of directors. You can go online and find video of him talking about what the objectives of the group is to create a God-led government. He has worked over the years to prevent not only abortion, but AIDS education overseas and so on. This has been a lifelong project for him going back years and years and years. Stupak is a little bit newer to this issue, and I think what you really have to question here is Pitts, who's been active in this for a long time and was bringing up these amendments. I think in Stupak and his brother in the family, as it's called, found a Democrat to carry the issue for him.
As Jeff noted in the book The Family, this cultish group is big on the idea that women are inferior to men. Women in the house have to wait on men, for instance, and even their clothes are constricted, and they're mostly excluded from power. So unsurprisingly, the family makes a big deal out of sperm power, and hate on the idea that mere women could interrupt what sperm causes. Indeed, the most amazing part of this entire healthcare reform process is how it's drawn out so much hostility from so many male members of Congress towards women. For instance, there was the completely out-of-control behavior of many congressional Republicans when female Democrats got up to speak about healthcare reform and women. Think Progress posted a compilation.
Unanimous consent to revise and extend my remarks in support of the Democratic bill.
Mr. Speaker, I object.
Mr. Speaker, parliamentary inquiry. Do I not have the right to be able to continue my sentence without objections that are trying to censor my remarks here on the floor that I have the right to make as a member of this House?
Objection is heard.
Speaker, Ms. Speaker, I object. As a mother of four and a grandmother of three, I ask unanimous consent to revise and extend my remarks in support of the Democratic bill.
Mr. Speaker, because the Democratic bill gives women more opportunities to enter the medical profession and the modern healthcare workforce, I ask unanimous consent to revise and extend my remarks in support of the Democratic bill.
Because it's time to protect older women by closing the donut hole, I ask unanimous consent to revise and extend my remarks.
If members
really, at this point, it's hard to avoid the sense that the shouters simply can't stand the idea of women speaking up for healthcare reform or speaking up for women's needs. A lot of the women speaking weren't even talking about abortion. But of course, this is never really about abortion, is it? It's about controlling women, and you got an earful of that right there. But even I was astonished at how blatant it was. The other big players in this were the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, who basically dictated the content of this amendment. It's no big news that the Catholic bishops are obsessed with sexuality in general, and female sexuality especially, but it's more than a little startling how much Congress is simply allowing religious groups to pretty much write legislation in direct violation of the First Amendment. But there's more than mere misogyny at hand. As Wendy Norris wrote at RH Reality Check, the Catholic bishops are also protecting the Vatican's lucrative investment in the healthcare industry. Catholic hospitals that don't provide abortion are at a disadvantage compared to those that do. And so pushing abortion out of the healthcare package available to women means that these hospitals don't have to compete as much. Of course, hospital-provided abortions are often done in emergency situations where the fetus is already dead. But when you're hating on sexual women, that's a minor distinction not worth bothering over. Luckily, the fact that this is basically about a bunch of men deciding to flex their powers to make life miserable for women didn't pass the attention of everyone in the mainstream media. Dr. Nancy Snyderman was blunt, saying what a lot of us are thinking.
Pay for that insurance, they would be subject to this new rule.
Kelly,
Nancy?
You know what I find so infuriating about this? I mean,
absolutely infuriating. And this is not about being pro-choice or pro-abortion or any of the hot-button lingo. We know women pay more for insurance than men. We know women are restricted in many states. And now it's basically, if you're a 50-year-old woman and you're in a monogamous relationship, you suddenly find yourself pregnant, you better know that you have an abortion rider in order to access health care that you thought you had. It is one more pressure on women. I mean, I'm surprised that, frankly, there isn't more outraged over the fact that this isn't fair.
This fight isn't over yet, people. We still have the Senate on hand to get this out of the bill. And now for the Wisdom of Wingnuts, still trying to defend murder of abortion providers edition. This time it's Ann Coulter comparing the reaction to the Fort Hood shooter to the reaction to Dr. Tiller's murder.
Obama said, "I am shocked and outraged by the murder of George Tiller." So the victim in that case was George Tiller. When the crazed Muslim shoots up an army base, he leaps out and says, "Don't jump to any conclusions," because he doesn't want us jumping to the obvious conclusion while liberals go to work manufacturing all the counterintuitive conclusions, which they've been pressing upon Americans for the past week, which is stress, stress, stress. That's all you've been getting from American news.
Except that the shooter in the Dr. Tiller case has admitted that he did it as a terrorist act and he has associations with anti-choice terrorist groups like Army of God. And the shooter in the Fort Hood case's motivations were still in question. The cases are not comparable since no one was saying that all Christians are responsible for Dr. Tiller's murder, but that's certainly Ann Coulter's implications about Muslims here.
That's it for this week's edition of Reality Cast. Please tune in next week for another dose of reality in the sexual health debate. Visit www.rhrealitycheck.org and sign up for our weekly e-newsletter, various news feeds, and daily emails. Thanks for listening and see you next week.